Welcome to the Informed Pregnancy and Parenting Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Elliot Berlin. I've interviewed women in the past who have delivered both head-down and breech babies vaginally and shared how those experiences differed for them. Today in the studio, we have a guest and her obstetrician who has delivered two breech babies, the first a cesarean breech birth and the second a vaginal breech birth after cesarean. Born in San Diego, California, our guest majored in biochemistry and cell biology at UCSD and then graduated from University of Southern California and now has a booming general and cosmetic dental practice in West Hollywood, right across the street from me. She and her husband have a 2-year-old son and an 8-month-old daughter, Dr. Donna Lou. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Nice to see you again.
Yeah.
Originally from Montreal, Canada, joining us today is an award-winning OBGYN who completed his residency at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center here in Los Angeles a short 37 years ago. And he continues to practice obstetrics and gynecology there today. He's one of the few remaining obstetricians who offers patients the option for vaginal breech birth in a hospital setting if they meet certain safety criteria. Dr. Barry Brock, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We had you a little while back on an episode all about breech, and then today we have a slightly different variation on that. So let's jump right in. Donna, you have two children, and they were both breech. Let's start with your first pregnancy, and then after the break, we can talk more about your most recent birth. At what point during your first pregnancy did you realize that your baby was breech?
Oh, the whole time.
You knew from the beginning?
Yeah. I mean, with all the ultrasounds, baby was always breech. It really wasn't...
How many ultrasounds did you do in your pregnancy?
I think at first they space them out every 6 weeks or something like that. And then after that, as you get closer and closer to your due date, you know, you have the anatomy scan at 20 weeks. And then I think every 2 weeks. And then in the last, you know...
So you did a lot of them.
I feel like I did a lot. Or maybe I just went to the doctor a lot. I'm not really sure. That was a long time ago.
Sure. Well, a lot has happened since then.
That's true.
That's for sure. But you already early in the pregnancy, halfway through the pregnancy, were you asking about position or they told you, hey, the baby's breech?
They would mention that the baby's breech, but then it was never really a thing, a concern because a lot of babies turn later on. Mm-hmm. So I really didn't think it was really an issue until probably... around 30, 32 weeks when my OB started becoming a little bit more concerned that he was still breech.
And at that time, you were with a different obstetrician,
yes.
not Dr. Brock, who's here tonight. Do you remember if they gave you options, what to do?
Yeah, he talked about doing an ECV and just trying to turn him, also acupuncture, inversions, things that I could do at home, just do it yourself at home, more or less. And then once the baby hit 36 weeks, I believe, we would attempt to turn him.
What was your birth plan up until that point?
Just try to do an all-natural vaginal birth if possible. But I was also warned by friends to take that birth plan and toss it out the door.
Yeah. I mean, so you weren't that married to the all-natural vaginal birth?
Not really. I think as it got closer and closer to my due date, every week the baby was still breech, and I started to accept the inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What of those things that was recommended to you by your doctor, what kind of things did you try?
I tried inversions. Which is where, and on spinningbabies.com. So I tried basically hanging off my sofa and then laying upside down on an ironing board, which I broke.
Oh, really?
I did.
Like while you were laying on it?
Yeah, I just heard a snap.
Oh, and, is that scary? Oh, it just broke but didn't fall out from under you?
No. It just bent.
Crack.
I just heard a big crack.
Uh-huh.
And
do you use it for ironing?
Not anymore.
I don't know. Okay.
I got a new one.
I got you. No, because most people, when I tell them, hey, maybe you want to do the ironing board thing, either they don't have one or like, oh, I think I have one, but they don't really use them.
I don't iron a whole lot. I like to steam. It's just easier.
It's more of a breech board.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you did the inversion.
I did the inversions. I did acupuncture and moxibustion.
Had you done acupuncture before that?
Yes. I did acupuncture to try and conceive, just to increase my chances.
And you conceived.
And I conceived.
So it must work.
Yeah. I did it both times.
Oh, with both babies?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
And then moxibustion is, you want to describe what that is?
It's basically some mugwort root, and it's an herb, and they roll it up, and they hold it close to your pinky toe.
Yeah.
And they hold it really close to your pinky toe until you feel this heat basically almost burning, and it's supposed to send signals to your uterus somehow.
It's like Chinese medicine is an umbrella with a whole bunch of modalities underneath it. So there's acupuncture, there's moxibustion, there's Chinese herbs and other modalities. So the moxa is heating up acupuncture points instead of needling them.
Mm-hmm.
And did you feel like it generally, when people do it for 15 or 20 minutes, they usually report more fetal movement afterwards. The baby starts bouncing around.
You know, I didn't. But I think it is worth noting that my amniotic fluid was on the lower side.
You had like 7 or something like that? Right.
Yeah. I think normal is like 5.
More than that, 8 to 24.
And I was just above whatever the lowest value was.
Before they start talking induction.
Yeah.
But you were early also at that point. You were doing these things at more like 34 weeks.
Yeah. So I think I started seeing you around 33, 34 weeks. And you gave me Dr. Brock's number, and I had scheduled a consultation with him.
But then you got a little surprise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Before we get to that, let me ask Dr. Brock a few questions here. First of all, how many ultrasounds do you typically do in a normal pregnancy?
Well, I start off with the first ultrasound to diagnose pregnancy to make sure it's into uterine.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll get a round for nuchal fold around 12 weeks.
Okay.
And then structural ultrasound. Around 18 to 22 weeks. And then routinely I'll get one after 41 weeks. You have to check the fluid.
Oh, so there's no 35, 36?
No, I find it managed. A lot of patients want to get it done, and I do it for them, but I don't see how it changes my management unless I'm not sure of the position.
Right.
Then I want to check the position.
So generally you check the position by hand?
I check my hand. If I have any concerns, I will go ahead and get an ultrasound. A quick ultrasound in the office, not a formal one, just to make sure where the position is.
Are newer doctors trained as well in hand palpation? Because they seem to always want the 36.
I all want to do ultrasounds. But then ultrasounds, right. The insurance company pay for it. I guess maybe that's a little motivation there,
too.
Oh,
it's a little extra bump. No pun intended. So that's how many you do. At what point do you start noticing or looking out for breech presentation? Because if you don't do one from 22 to 40 weeks, but you're palpating all the time by hand.
I'm more concerned to get it to know by 36 weeks, because at 37 weeks is when I'll try to turn the baby. So I want to know and I have to schedule it. So I have to know by 36 weeks.
And before that, do you look at all?
I mark it what it is, but I don't have concerns about it. I tell the patient, well, listen, the baby's breech still, and let's see what happens by 36 weeks. If it's not, then we have to talk about trying to turn the baby at 37 weeks.
And so you turn the baby manually. Are there factors that make you feel like a baby is more or less likely to turn?
Yes, obviously. Biggest factor probably is the size of the fluid and the shape of the uterus. I have a patient who came in today, and she has a bicornered uterus, and the chance of turning is pretty small.
Did I send her to you? I think I did.
And she also, unfortunately, the baby is really low, the butt.
Okay.
There's no way in heck this kid's going to turn.
Okay.
This butt's really deep in the pelvis, and she's a bicornered uterus. Most of the time, my bicornered uterus, I find out if I've done a cesarean section, that's when I find out. She happened to have this knowledge beforehand, they said. And
can you just talk about what a bicornered uterus is? So
the uterus forms
sense.
Itself by two halves, as most of your body, and joined together. In her case, it didn't join all the way together. So you basically almost have two uteruses kind of stuck together, half of each. But it's a different shape. So the baby, it's not a round shape. So the baby has an ability to move around. And once it gets its butt ending stuck in the pelvis, it's not going to move around.
Mm-hmm.
This baby got its butt in there, and it's going to stay there. So it's going to either come out by cesarean section or vaginal breech delivery.
So it's a healthy pregnancy, but is it kind of like a heart shape at the top where there's a little dent in the middle?
But usually when it's bicornered, when you do delivery, you have one side's very big and the other side may be very, very small.
I see.
You know, it's a dent in the beginning.
Compacted into one side.
It's compacted one. And it's a dent in the beginning of the pregnancy, but as one side, it's only in one side, and the pregnancy grows, that side becomes much bigger.
I see.
And the baby just can't move around, healthy and fine. The babies may be a little bit smaller sometimes because the uterus isn't as big. But usually it's just an incidental finding that we've, oh my gosh, yeah, that's why I couldn't turn the baby. That's why it's breech.
Do you look for it during the cesarean or it becomes obvious?
Oh, it's obvious during the cesarean section. Yeah.
Maybe we'll post some pictures. And so you said the shape of the uterus and then also the size of the baby?
Well, the size of the baby and also, you know, if mother's diabetic and the baby's very, very big, I mean, less chance the baby turning the baby, the size of the baby. But usually in our country, we do it around 37 weeks to try to turn the baby because the feeling is if it hasn't turned by 37 weeks, the chance of turning is much less. And the other philosophy is that if we do an aversion, try aversion, something occurs during the aversion, the heart rate goes down or something like that. If we had to do a cesarean section, the baby's 37 weeks, so the baby's fine and healthy. I've never had it happen to me, but that's why we do it at 37
that's
weeks in this
concern.
Country.
Yeah.
In Europe, they do it earlier, 34 weeks, and they have a greater success rate.
But because the babies are smaller.
The babies are smaller.
Okay. Yeah. Do you also look at fluid levels?
Yes. The success rate is based upon the fluid level. Obviously, the higher the fluid level, the more success it is. But if the fluid's really low and, you know, a normal fluid's wanted over 9, but if it's, you know, some fluid's like 4 or 5 or 6, you know, the chance of the baby turning is small. The biggest criteria is you have to get the buttocks out of the pelvis. It's not a matter of bringing the head into the pelvis. You have to get the buttocks out of the pelvis or wherever's in the pelvis.
Or foot. Or...
no one can get into that spot unless you get what's in there out of it.
Yeah, which I think was a lot of the philosophies on the inversions coming from, that gravity will, if you're hanging out there slightly tilted, gravity will naturally help whatever's stuck in the pelvis come out.
Hopefully not stuck, because stuck by definition is not going to come out.
It's not coming out. Whatever's leaning towards the pelvis will come out. You know, in our office, what we do is we try to improve your musculoskeletal function. So if your low back, hips, and pelvis are very tight and stiff and restricted and don't have much give to them, then we try to work to loosen up the soft tissues. We use massage and deep tissue work to loosen up the muscles and tendons, and then we use chiropractic adjustments to get the joints moving better so that the pelvis is more fluid. And you can feel a big difference between a pelvis that's really rigid and stuck and not moving at all and a pelvis that's very loose and fluid and moves nicely. And those are the structures that are around the baby, so the theory is that we're giving them more functional space to move around. I remember when I met you, your muscles were both very strong and also very tight. And I thought, this pelvis does not move well at all. But then also you had a low amount of fluid, and the baby had been breached for a long time. So on paper, you're not the greatest candidate for getting a baby to turn.
The best chance of turning a baby is if this is not a first baby, multiparous patient, very lax abdomen. The worst case is young, healthy, very strong abdominal muscles of first babies. You're in great shape, but it's terrible for turning a baby.
I like to work out sometimes.
It's the whatever the opposite of lax abdomen is what Donna is. So we worked together a little bit. We didn't have a lot of time. And then also, so I always recommend to patients, just so that you know the options. Some people would not want to do a vaginal breech birth. Some people would, and some people won't know until they consult with the doctor who's comfortable doing them. But I always make the point that in Los Angeles, you do have that choice if you want it. So you were going to consult with Dr. Brock, and then what happened next?
I went into labor. Well, actually, I think what happened initially, I was actually at the hospital doing a labor and delivery class, getting ready, you know.
Oh, like your birthing class?
Yeah, my birthing class. And I thought I felt a leak, so I ended up going into the hospital later that evening, and they checked everything to make sure I didn't my sac was not punctured and I wasn't leaking, and everything was actually fine. But you know, they did do a cervical check or something, and I think it was maybe a week after that I went into labor. So it was actually several cervical checks that I received that I think might have like prompted it, but maybe the baby's just ready. I don't know.
Too much checking? Because you were like 30. How many weeks were you?
I was 36 on the dot.
And your water broke?
No, I just spontaneously went into labor.
You started having contractions?
Yeah, I'm not even sure if my labor broke because I got into a warm bath.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually did help alleviate the pain. I wasn't even sure I was in labor. And then I got into a warm bath to see if I could alleviate these cramps. I thought the cramps was from a cervical check.
Oh, I see.
That I received, I think, like 24 hours before that. And then it actually helped my cramps a lot. And
being once, in the warm water?
Being in the warm water, yeah. I would say, you know, starting off, my labor pains were probably at like a 5. And then once I got into the bath, it went down to 3. But then I just got really warm because being pregnant in a warm bath is
overheat.
Just, yeah, not very comfortable. And as soon as I came out, my pain level shot up to like 8 or 9. So I'm not sure if my water broke in the water or in the bath or not.
And what did you do next?
I went to the hospital. and then
did you know you were in labor?
After I got out of the bath.
You thought this is labor.
Yeah, I had been laboring at home. It actually woke me up in the middle of the night around 4:30. And once I got out of the bath, it was probably around 6:30. Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized I was in labor. And when I got to the hospital, I think I was 8 centimeters dilated.
Do you know what time that was?
6:45.
Oh, you're very close to the hospital.
Oh, yeah. I was 5 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in 2 hours of labor with your first baby and breech, you got to 8 centimeters.
8 centimeters. And I pretty much felt the urge to push as they were wheeling me into surgery.
No kidding. So did they ever talk about just letting you go?
No. Not at the hospital.
Hmm. And were you thinking in your mind, if I'm this close?
I really wanted to, but I knew my OB at the time was not trained in vaginal breech births, and I hadn't met Dr. Brock yet, so I didn't really feel like I had any options.
Oh.
Yeah.
Do people ever call you Dr. Brock when that's happening?
No. I mean, they don't call me in the hospital.
Like never
met
me before.
Could I have called you?
It's kind of tough. I mean, you know, if your doctor called me.
That's what I mean, your colleagues.
If your doctor called me, I would have come in and helped him go through vaginal breech delivery.
That's what I mean. I know that at some point, like, this has happened where it was a surprise breach. They didn't realize. And then they just called Dr. Crane to come over, and he just caught the baby. I mean, that's all there was
to
it at that point. Yeah, they've done it to you, too.
Yeah.
I was wondering. So.
Yeah.
So it could be an option if you really wanted it. You might have been able to say, in retrospect, to your
well,
doctor.
Well, no. I mean, I'm
could
another,
we see if
she's
Dr.
seen
Brock
another
is
doctor
around.
And never seen me. That doctor would have to call me and ask him to do a favor. I'm not going to. Patients are calling me and says, you're in labor. I'm not going to.
No, not
over.
A patient. I'm just saying if it's a doctor that knows you perhaps and works with you and as a colleague might say, hey, I have an 8-centimeter breach progressing quickly. Would you come check?
Yeah. I was just trying to get moment to – I was just going to the next minute.
No, there's no way in the moment.
No. Nope.
I would have thought of that myself. I just knowing that it's happened before makes me wonder if it's possible for somebody. Mm-hmm. In the moment. They must have had to move quickly because you were already 8 centimeters progressing quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was the baby coming down already?
Yes. I think I know I was 8 centimeters and I think it was +1.
Oh, wow.
So I, and my body just, I think.
Knew what to do.
Yeah. 15, 20 minutes, I already felt the urge to push and I knew I could have.
Oh.
Yeah. I just knew I could have.
It's like almost if you stayed in the car like an extra 15 minutes, they wouldn't have had a choice.
Yeah.
No kidding. What was the procedure like, this cesarean birth?
Well, you know, they gave me the epidural, what I thought was an epidural, but I think it was a spinal.
Okay.
And I was really, really groggy the whole surgery. I was fighting with every ounce of my being to stay conscious. I just wanted to, like, I just felt like I was going to pass out the whole time.
Is that normal with a spinal block?
No, not a spinal block, but, you know, there's a lot of adrenaline, things going on. Your body's going through a lot of things right now. Some people just, you know, get exhausted and tired, you know what I mean? And now that you don't have any pain, no motivation to keep you awake, so you just...
Still felt pain?
No, I didn't feel any pain. I didn't feel any pain. But I possibly was a nurse. No, it was my other OB suggested it might be because I tend to have very low blood pressure.
Oh.
And, you know, epidurals and spinals can
lower
drop it even
somewhere.
Lower.
Yeah, and they probably didn't have a whole lot of time to give you fluid if you...
No, I had no time.
So usually get a bag of fluid to bolster your pressure
before
they do the anesthesia.
Yeah.
So that would be considered an emergency cesarean. because there's only really two nomenclatures, scheduled cesarean and emergency cesarean. So it's sort of like a non-urgent.
Well, there's three. There's scheduled, an emergency, and a crash. So an emergency is a crash is someone, all of a sudden the heart rate goes down, and you have to escape baby out within the next 5-10 minutes.
Crash is what most people would think of as emergency,
no,
I think.
Emergency is a non-scheduled cesarean section.
Right, which would be a much nicer way to put it.
Yes.
than emergency. Because it's not always urgent, it just wasn't planned.
Right.
And wasn't scheduled. Is a cesarean like that performed differently than a scheduled cesarean?
No. Except for the fact that nowadays at least I've been doing for the last several years, is we give an extra antibiotic, azithromycin, so it lowers your chance of infection. And we also do, if someone's in labor, give a vaginal prep, a betadine prep that we used to do for D&Cs, things like that. And that's also shown to decrease the chance of getting an infection afterwards.
Infection. Is a breech cesarean different than a head-down cesarean?
Well, yes and somewhat, but you have the ability when you're doing a breech delivery, you have to do the same maneuvers to get the baby out. You have to get the butt if you can, or the feet. But you have the ability, if you need more room, you just widen the incision in the uterus. You don't have that ability vaginally.
Vaginally, right.
So that makes a huge difference. But usually if someone is a good surgeon, does these things, it's not a very difficult thing to do. But there'd be other conflicting factors, though. Someone may be a breech because you have a big fibroid there, and they may get in your way doing a cesarean section. But that's what an obstetrician is trained for to do.
Mm-hmm. How is the recovery for you from your cesarean?
It was pretty difficult. I definitely was given a lot of painkillers. You know, it wasn't great. in the hospital, I was just throwing up a lot. And I'm not somebody who gets a lot of – I'm not someone who – I never got any morning sickness.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just throwing up constantly, even with water. And I just couldn't – I could not even stand up straight.
Wow.
I just felt like my incisions would pull every single time I try to stand up straight. So I was walking around hunchback probably.
For how long?
At least a week and a half.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I think after.
That just with everything else new going on, it seems like not the ideal state.
Yeah. And I'm not somebody who likes to sit down.
I know that
a lot.
About you.
I just really felt the need to clean my house when I got home.
Obviously, your child also doesn't want you to sit down, too.
That's right.
That's true.
There's a lot of work to do
That's
there.
That's true, too. So it was a lot of – it was pretty difficult.
All right. I would like – you have a less than one-year-old now.
Yes. 8 months.
8-month-old. And we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we'll find out more about your second pregnancy and birth. Stay tuned to the Informed Pregnancy Podcast. This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike, Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby, not even diaper rash.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Welcome back to the Informed Pregnancy Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Elliot Berlin, and we're continuing our discussion of breech birth after cesarean with Dr. Barry Brock and Dr. Donna Liu. So last year I started to see you again about midway through your second pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And being pregnant after having previously had a cesarean kind of leaves you two choices, right? You can opt for a repeat cesarean, an elective repeat cesarean, or a trial of labor after cesarean, called TOLAC, in the hopes of doing a vaginal birth after cesarean, a VBAC. At what point did you start to think about these options, and where were you leaning?
I think around 30 weeks when she was still breech. I definitely started exploring the option of doing a VBAC breech delivery.
Well, in the beginning of the pregnancy, did you know before you got pregnant if you wanted to do a repeat cesarean or if you wanted to do a vaginal birth?
A vaginal.
You wanted VBAC.
Mm-hmm.
Did you explore the different benefits and risks to doing a VBAC versus a repeat cesarean?
Not until later.
But in your heart, you just wanted to do the vaginal birth.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, a lot of people are like that. Dr. Brock, what are some of the pros and cons, not with a breech baby, but just in terms of VBAC in general?
Well, I mean, the American colleges, and I concur with it, the incidence of problems that less than 0.5%, and they encourage to have a vaginal delivery after previous cesarean sections, especially if you have a non-repeating cause. In other words, patient had a cesarean section for breech, this time the head's down, it's not a repeating cause. If you have a cesarean section previously because the baby's occiput posterior, sunny side up, may baby come down rapidly, entirely different. And over the years, I've done lots of VBACs. Like I said, the risk of a problem is less than 1 out of 200. Mm-hmm. That the uterus may rupture, but we're monitoring carefully. One thing I do when I do breech, VBACs, is I want the patient in the hospital. I want to monitor the baby, make sure everything's doing fine.
Because normally, if they're in labor, you don't care if they come in at the very end.
As long as if they're not ruptured, I can labor at home. I have no problem with that. If they're ruptured and have a beta strep, then I want them to come in and get some antibiotics.
You mean if the water is ruptured?
Right.
Okay. But with the VBACs, the concern is that the uterus might open up, the scar in the old uterus might open up, so you prefer to monitor that earlier in labor.
Exactly.
What are some signs that it might happen? Might have happened.
Well, the tracing may be abnormal in the baby, severe pain over the incision site, and usually sine qua non of it is that the baby's all of a sudden loses station, so the presenting part moves back up because it's coming out of the pelvis.
Dropping, and now all of a sudden they're not low; they're higher.
Exactly,
up.
Exactly, they're higher up.
Are there ways to mitigate that risk of that weakness in the uterine scar from separating?
If you're going to give, you want to give Pitocin, you don't want to give prostaglandins to stimulate labor. That's been shown to higher risk of rupture.
Mm-hmm.
So Pitocin's fine with the dosage. You may also use it
with a lower dosage.
Follow the same protocol. That's not a problem. But you may want to do is interuriine pressure catheter measure exactly the strength of the contractions.
I see.
You want to make sure that the baby's doing fine, the mummy's doing fine. Epidural is an option, but usually I tend towards, I like the idea of an epidural. What I do, I lose the ability to use pain as an
indicator.
But I also have the advantage that if, God forbid, something happens, then I can rush into a cesarean section very
quickly. The
crash
cesarean.
That would be a crash cesarean.
I'm learning the terminology.
I haven't had one yet, but yes. Well, I take it back. I've had as a resident, but not my own patients.
So not in the past 37 years?
Right.
Okay. It's a pretty good record. And you do a lot of VBACs.
I have a lot of VBACs, and I do, even after two cesarean sections, I have several patients.
You do
patients.
VBAC after two? How about VBAC after three?
No.
Ah, you have your limits.
I have my limits. And the percentage of after two, they talk of risk of rupture of 5%.
Uh-huh.
But it goes up much higher after.
I had a patient who did a VBAC after six.
I mean, it's possible.
Yeah.
You can also go home and not wear your seatbelt and speed, but it may not be the safest thing to do.
You know, I think that what her OB told her was that there's no data either way. There's no data on the safety of your seventh cesarean, and there's no data on the safety of a VBAC after six. And so if she had a strong preference, he was comfortable seeing how labor would go and whether or not they would make it through.
There is some data out of USC and the risk of rupture. That's where it came from. This data came from the 70s, and so the reason is they were doing like 24,000 deliveries a year.
Wow.
They were like 5% of all the deliveries in the United States. It was mind-boggling what they were doing there. And they couldn't get to the cesarean sections quick enough, so they had patients delivering vaginally after for cesarean sections. Then they looked back in their data, and that's where came out the idea that VBACs can be safe, because back in the 60s and 70s, it says once a section, always a section was the rule. And they looked back and said, hey, you know, we've had all these patients deliver vaginally after previous nurses, and they're all safe.
That's really interesting.
And the data came from there. But it also showed the rupture was higher after more cesarean sections. Yeah. So,
but there's also increased risk with each cesarean that you do as well.
Well, I mean, you can get the risk of the biggest risk, the more cesarean section you do, the placenta may implant improperly into the wall of the uterus, the more scar you have. Mm-hmm. And as the things, as implants in the wall of the uterus and doesn't separate, it's called an accreta. And that increases the risk of bleeding after the baby's born and hemorrhaging and risk of losing the uterus.
Right.
So the more cesarean section you have, that's the greater the risk. And the scar tissue going in, it just may take you longer time to get in to do the cesarean section because there's more scar tissue, more tissue going through multiple surgeries. But you want to go ahead and, you know, if you have an epidural or spinal, it just takes you longer time to go in. A good surgeon should be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Donna, 23 weeks into the pregnancy, you started coming in for chiropractic and massage work. Was that more for aches and pains, or was that for general wellness, or was that like, I'm going to be proactive on this breech baby?
Probably a little bit of both. I did have a little bit of a sciatic a little earlier on in this second pregnancy. So that's why I started seeing you. And eventually it was more trying to get loosen up the pelvic muscles and the muscles around the uterus so that she would turn.
Mm-hmm. And at your first birth, was there any sign when they did the surgery? Did they see any variations in your uterus, as we talked about in the first part, that might have been the cause of your breech?
No.
What is the incidence of breech overall in let's say, first-time moms?
Well, it's overall 6%, and Mother Nature does it. We know certain things increase the chance of a breech, malformed uterus, earlier on in the pregnancy. If you go into labor, more likely to be breech, history of breech.
So history of breech increases the chances of being breech again, even if there's none of the malformation?
Correct. Yeah, slightly. But, you know, it kind of makes sense. You know, what caused it? We don't know what caused it the first time. Obviously, Mother Nature, the thing. Obviously, that's the uterine things, the extra outside the uterus fibroids that change the shape of it. Unfortunately, the other things going on, abnormalities of the baby sometimes. But a lot of times, this is, with ultrasound, it's much more effective, and you can pick out those things. There's marked abnormalities that babies have that we can know that can cause a baby to breech, but a lot of times you can pick that with the ultrasound, so it's not a problem.
So in both of your pregnancies, you were breached from very early on.
Mm-hmm.
You saw it early on.
Mm-hmm.
You and the second one did more things early on to try to give your baby more space to turn. And actually, it sort of felt like your baby had room to turn.
A little bit more, I would say.
Towards the end. I mean, you had more fluid.
Yeah. Not that much. I would say, so my first one, I would say I probably had like 9 or 10 cubic
centimeters.
And this one I might have had like 12 to 15.
Yeah.
Not a lot.
Well, it's
normal.
It's normal, but I think 12 to 15. And also, I sort of remember in the first one you were down more like 7 or 8. So I would say 7 to 15 is a big jump. It just in terms of the way it feels, you know, water in the bathtub, basically.
Right.
More fluid in there, more room to move
right.
around.
Right. I could just tell she was just as stuck as he was.
He was?
Mm-hmm.
So, but you were still not with Dr. Brock.
No.
At what point did you decide to consult with Dr. Brock?
33 weeks.
33. And how was your consultation? What did you learn?
I learned that being a VBAC breech delivery are two separate sets of risks. Dr. Brock explained to me the differences between the set of risks for each and that they don't necessarily compound and increase my chances of something going wrong.
So that's really interesting because we just talked about a few minutes ago the pros and cons or risks and benefits of just doing a vaginal birth after cesarean with a head down baby. Isolating breech, what are some of the pros and cons of vaginal birth with a breech baby versus cesarean birth with a breech baby?
Well, I mean, the risks, the only concern you have is the breech baby coming out. Normally, as you come out in labor, the head sometimes, if it's tight fit, the head will get molded. And the bones are not fused. So Mother Nature designs a system. The bones is kind of turn the baby's head into bananas. You're pushing, trying to get this baby out. Mm-hmm. And the bones and everything else. Well, in a breech delivery, it'll do the same thing after the baby's out, that head. The trouble is the cord's right beside that head. So while you're molding the head, the baby's not getting oxygenation.
You're compressing the cord.
Exactly. So you cannot, that cannot happen. So we use certain criteria. Once someone I do doing a breech vaginal delivery, I want to make sure once she gets in the active phase of labor, she can get there any way she wants, induced, non-induced, doesn't make it. When she gets there in 6 or 7 centimeters, then I want to see everything go smoothly and quickly and nice, which means I want her to dilate quickly. I want to start pushing. Push effectively the baby's butt to come down and push the baby out quickly. Mm. You're not going to push for 3-4 hours, not for breech delivery. That gives me an idea that this baby's going to slide out. And it does. Every time I've done it, that's what happens because I meet the criteria. I didn't do that when I was a resident. We considered a breech and vertex the same thing. And we got into trouble some babies. And that's, I think, why the literature in the past scared everyone. And now, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you don't have the skill to do it, you don't do it.
A couple of questions. Are there people who come in and you determine they're not a good candidate for breech birth before labor starts?
Yes.
What are those criteria?
Well, the criteria would be that definitely if their feet are coming down and not the buttocks.
So because butt down presentation.
Right. The reason is the baby shall dilate and it'll baby come down. But now the cervix may not dilate all the way because it just has to squeeze through the legs coming through and the chest and everything else. And it gets to the head and all of a sudden. And we saw talk about cervix clamping down. The cervix is not clamped down. It just never dilated. Mm-hmm. And then you're stuck. Now, yes, over the years, I've done occasionally some...
I'm just trying to picture it. So the cervix only opens, let's say, the 7 centimeters. Most of the baby comes out, but the head
needs
10 centimeters,
right.
And it gets stuck.
Exactly. So I want a breech delivery, so a breech in the buttocks, you can see it needs more room to get that through, and that helps you
the
decide.
The butt and legs kind of come out together.
And Mother Nature will tell you, I had a patient who years ago, and came in, rapidly dialed everything, she started to push, this butt did not go anywhere. It was really high. And they did a cesarean section. The kid weighed 9 pounds. Mother Nature's telling you something here.
Yeah.
If it's not coming out nicely, and that's the criteria. And using that criteria, I've been very successful. And knock on wood, I've never had a problem with it. But that's because I skewed from the data. I'm erring the side of more conservatism.
Gotcha. You tried to do an external cephalic version.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you manually try to turn the baby.
Yeah.
Is that always preferable to just delivering breech?
Yes. I always think so because it's a safer procedure. I don't have to worry about any of the things I talked about before. If the head's down, she can push for 3 hours. I don't care, even for previous cesarean section, because when the head's down low, below the scar, the chances of rupturing is very, very small. You can just imagine the scar is above the kid's head, so the head's pushing its way out. Even if something happens, the kid's baby's coming out. You should be
fine. You've got it. I see.
Yeah.
So that's in this case with the VBAC added to the breech.
Well, two separate problems, like I explained. And so, you know, we talked the risk of a rupture less than 0.5%, and we're going to monitor that. And then the breech.
Which, by the way, for some people that sounds like a lot, and some people it sounds like a little. When you're talking about risk, I mean, if you told me my chances of winning the Powerball are 1 in 200, I'd buy a ticket every time.
Well, that's why they get you suckered in there. That's a pretty low risk, 1 in 200.
Sure, but on the other right, it's a 99.5% chance that it won't happen to you.
Right.
I haven't won the Powerball yet. I'm just saying. What are you doing during the ECV? What's the procedure?
Well, the number one criteria I do. Well, first we make sure the baby's fine and healthy. Actually. Back up. When she comes to the hospital, the first thing we do is scan to make sure kid didn't flip.
Okay.
Before we admit her to the hospital and do all that stuff.
Actually, funny story. There was a resident a medical student. He was still in medical school. He did an ultrasound to make sure that the baby's, you know, head was up.
Yeah.
And he put it where the butt was. And he said, oh, yeah, that's the baby's head.
Oh.
But he was wrong.
Well, he had a little bit more to learn.
That's why
it was
green to sell the med students.
It was sweet.
Well, first thing I confirm. And then we'll go ahead and do a non-stress test where we listen to the baby's heartbeat, make sure the baby's fine and healthy and accelerating. And then I go ahead and give some medication called terbutaline. Terbutaline is a medication we use for asthmatics, things like this. And it has the effect of relaxing the uterus because I don't want any contractions. I want the uterus nice and relaxed. And then I use some warm mineral oil, and I key factor doing the inversion is you got to get the butt out of the pelvis. You put your hand down low and try to push the butt out of the pelvis. And if you get the butt of the pelvis, then you guide the head into the pelvis.
So this is all external.
External. You're everything's
through
external.
The belly trying to push that right. butt
but
out of the pelvis.
See, is the secret is down low, trying to get the butt out of the pelvis.
You do have an exceptionally high success rate with your versions, I think, compared to the average, for sure. The tributyline that you give is an injection?
It's injection. I give it IV. You can give sub-Q. I give it 0.2 milligrams. It's a very, very low dose. And the biggest side effect that the heart may race for about 10 minutes or so.
And but the goal is to relax the uterus so that you have a better playing field right. or so that labor doesn't start or both?
No, no. It's not the playing. Just the uterus relaxes so I have – if the uterus is contracting down, I can't turn the baby.
So
I'm trying to relax the uterus so I can build me. And also it helps
– It's kind of what I'm doing with the muscles and tendons.
Right. What I do – I cheat and I do it
with drugs.
Pharmaceutical with drugs. But I also, what goes against it, a mother that is in very good shape and very strong muscles and cannot relax her muscles. Mm-hmm. Just to say to relax your muscles, sometimes you can't do that.
You
someone's
can't.
Pushing on it.
Yeah.
It's nothing.
It's instinct.
Nothing wrong. It's instinct and you do that. And a lot of times it can be very, very successful. My success rate is around, I guess, about 60% or so. Mm-hmm. But nothing's 100%. There's a whole list of criteria that higher and less likely to succeed. But I always say it's worth a try.
What can go wrong?
Theoretically, it can fail. Okay, that's number one, but that's not going right.
That's, no.
You can go ahead as you're trying to turn the baby, the heart rate may drop, and you listen to heartbeat with the ultrasound machine while I'm doing that every 10, 15, 20 seconds to make sure it stays up. And that's why we do it at 37 weeks, and there have been reported cases, even at Cedars, that they do with cesarean sections. Knock on wood, I've never had it happen to me. You turn the baby and heart rate drops. Sometimes you just push back in the other direction. Maybe you're pulling in a cord, maybe twisting. I don't know the answer.
But I also think some of the more nervous obstetricians, as soon as that heart rate drops, they run for a crash cesarean without trying to put it back. So,
yeah, you can. Mother Nature's pretty good. Baby recovers. Baby, it's, you know, you're panicking over someone holding your breath for 15 seconds.
Right.
It's, you know, let's see what happens. Mother
right.
Nature's designed this
system
pretty good.
It's also a pretty litigious society, so it's sort of defensive medicine. you really can't blame a doctor for defensive
no.
medicine. So those are the things that could possibly go wrong. In your case, the version didn't work.
Nope.
Was it close? Was there a...
Nope.
Maybe? Nothing. Yeah.
No, I knew she was in there. And I was hopeful,
yeah.
but I was pretty certain she wasn't going to turn. She was wedged in there. I could tell.
But being wedged in there is sort of good if you're going to do a vaginal breech birth.
Yes.
She's kind of butt
not
engaged.
Good for a version.
Not good for the version. Okay. So that left you with really two choices, repeat cesarean or vaginal breech after cesarean.
Mm-hmm.
Did you weigh the options back and forth?
I did. But it was – I just felt like – the risk of a VBAC breech delivery was worth it. It definitely made me nervous. A lot of my family was nervous for me.
Okay.
They were very nervous for me, more than I was. But I feel like – I felt like I could really trust my own body and I knew what I was capable of and I knew I could do it.
Did it make a difference that the first birth was so quick? I mean, is that sort of a good –
That makes it very, very good. That makes you very more likely for having a VBAC and also makes everything to the size and the pelvis, it all fits together, it would slide out. And this is what happened.
How did your second labor start?
Dr. Brock actually more or less induced me with a membrane strip.
Mm-hmm. What is a membrane strip?
You go ahead during an examination and you put your fingers in the opening of the cervix and you sweep with your finger. And that separates the mammies a little bit from the cervix. And
the
it
bag
also
of
makes,
water?
Well, the bag of water is the other side of the membrane, so you don't break the water.
Right. So you're just moving the membrane, which
right.
is holding
you're
the water.
Yeah, and you're separating. And that stimulates things and put out prostaglandins and bring on labor.
Okay. Did it bring on labor for you?
Yeah. I actually – well, I was cramping for the rest of the afternoon, the evening, and then I had also – that night I even had sex.
Mm-hmm.
And I used some
deliberately because you wanted to go into labor.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I did not feel like.
But I was. I'm all creepy. How about you, honey? But wait, this is also you were going out of town.
I don't remember.
Yes, if I remember he was going out of town.
Which would leave you no options, really.
Yeah. C-section.
Well, I was just saying would leave you no vaginal birth option. So if you were going to have the choice for vaginal birth, you needed to move some things along, mm-hmm. which is why all these things, I think, came into play for
right.
you.
Right. So that evening, I also had sex with my husband, and then I took some evening primrose oil.
Orally?
Orally and also vaginally.
Vaginally both. Okay.
I was just hitting it from all different
Everything
angles.
Everything you can think mm-hmm. of. Mm-hmm.
And it worked. The next morning, my cramping slowly turned into just these little contractions that were very, very mild. It almost just felt like a twitch. Mm-hmm. But they were really regular for every 10 minutes, and at times they just disappear.
And where did it go from there?
I think I came and saw you. I wasn't even sure if I was in labor.
In labor or not.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah. And just to prep my body and loosen up everything for a vaginal breech delivery if it got to that point. And then
– I was one step after evening primrose.
Yeah. and then that – evening, my labor actually stalled mm-hmm. around 7-8 o'clock.
That was almost 24 hours after everything began.
Yeah, and it almost stalled. And
did it ever get more than twitchy for you during
that
time?
It got slightly uncomfortable, but not to the point where I felt like I was in labor. It definitely was not active labor.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing that he was about to go on vacation, I jumped on a yoga ball and just started rolling around on it as much as I could. And actually, it did jumpstart my labor. So that was probably around 8 o'clock. I jumped on the yoga ball, and we ended up going to the hospital probably around 10 o'clock.
2 hours again?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I was – when I got to the hospital, I was 4 centimeters dilated. And I was really excited because I knew that I could spend the rest of my labor comfortable because I was getting an epidural since Dr. Brock wanted me to.
Mm-hmm. So, and after the epidural, you didn't feel too much?
Oh, it took me a long time to get the epidural.
Oh, it took a while. So
yeah.
You labored there for a bit.
Because
you wanted to wait?
No, I was in triage
uh-huh.
And my water broke in triage.
Oh.
And about 45 minutes after I got there, and the nurse checked me, and I was 10 centimeters.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You got your epidural?
No. I'm still in triage. They haven't even admitted me into the hospital.
You were 10 centimeters but still didn't have an epidural?
No.
Okay.
And they forced –
But you like the epidural for the vaginal breech birth.
Because if I have to manipulate and move things around, I don't want the mother in pain.
Right.
Because if she moves up the table, that's the worst thing that can happen.
Sure. But even if it's moving that quickly?
If it happens, it's, you know.
Right. You may not have a chance.
You don't have the chance. You know?
Oh, so you did almost all your labor with no epidural.
I went to 10 centimeters, yeah, pretty much within 45 minutes. And then all the anesthesiologists were busy for about another hour and a half.
Oh, no kidding. So you sat at 10 for a while.
Yeah.
Until it all came together.
Mm-hmm.
How was pushing for you?
It's 15 minutes.
Quick.
I've just heard these horror stories about, you know, women pushing
You dilated very rapidly. You had a previous, got up to 8 centimeters. Wasn't huge. You had a great chance for quick, easy delivery.
Yeah.
Sweet. Do you do things differently when you're attending the breech birth? I mean, epidural is one because I know that you normally don't care if your clients have epidural or not.
Right. I mean, differently how?
I don't know. Are there ways that you attend a breech birth differently?
Well, I make sure I'm there.
That's the right
one. I mean.
Thank you for that.
It takes me some time to get in. I'm not there in 5 minutes. It takes me, you know. Depends what time of day and night, the traffic and everything else to get there. But yeah, once you go in there, it's similar to the delivery. You start pushing. I'd set things up in the room. And you're not setting things up in the cesarean section room because, like I said before, you have to deliver. Once you're committed to delivering vaginally and the feet are out, you have to deliver vaginally. There's no option. You can't put the baby back in.
But you said during the cesarean breech birth, if the head's not coming out, you just make a wider incision, but you can't do that vaginally. So what would you do if the head was having trouble coming through?
You use forceps.
Regular forceps?
No, they're specially designed forceps for breech delivery called Piper forceps.
Okay. So you have Piper forceps whenever
you do a
breech
room.
Birth?
And if I use my criteria, I haven't used those in many, many years because if I use the criteria of everything quickly, usually you don't need them.
You don't need them because the baby just comes out.
It's like be prepared, Boy Scouts, and have them there.
So when you trained as a resident, breech birth was happening regularly.
Well, 6%.
But I'm saying vaginal breech birth was happening regularly. They didn't shuffle everybody over to a scheduled cesarean like we pretty much do now. But now we don't do them that often. So it's kind of rare for residents to get exposure to a breech birth. I know. Did you have residents in the room with you?
No. I just had a couple nurses. I hadn't, you know, it was just a few nurses and you.
I don't remember. Usually the residents are popping into watch.
No.
I remember I was doing doula work at a breech birth with you, and it was like 3 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning. And I was just sort of helping mom. She had been unmedicated because she progressed so quickly. And I think maybe you did a pudendal nerve block, but she was not numb. So we were breathing and coaching. And right up until the point you came in the room, it was her and her husband and a labor and delivery nurse and me and her friend. And I really wasn't paying attention to what was going on behind me. She was totally comfortable with residents coming in, with nurses coming in to watch and see and get experience. And she's also, I think, blind as a bat without her glasses, so she didn't really know what was going on in terms of people gathering. But I turned around at some point, and I swear there must have been 20 people in the room there. And I was even trying to figure out who they were based on their, you know, like the color of their scrubs. There were some labor and delivery nurses, some NICU team, some residents. I'm pretty sure there were 2 helpful Honda guys. I'm not sure how they got in there. It was just like everybody wanted to come see this vaginal breech.
Well, I mean, you have 5 neonatology team there for breech deliveries.
Oh, it's just in case.
Just in case. And they come with a team of 5 of them because neonatologists, the resident, a respiratory therapist, in case.
Mm-hmm.
They're always there for breech delivery. That's part of the protocol in case something needs to resuscitate the baby. And then there's the residents and the nurses who want to watch because
they don't get to very
often.
Is there a way for residents to get enough experience like you did when you were a resident so that they would feel confident and comfortable attending breech birth? You know, is this a dying art or is this going
to... It's a dying art. There's basically 2 obstetricians at Cedars that do vaginal breech delivery, and Paul doesn't do as many, and there's myself, and that's it. And I'm not doing 20, 30 breech deliveries a month. So at the residents, there's a lot of residents at Cedars. They'll each may get a 1 or 2 breech deliveries. Now, I'm very willing to come along and anytime someone's in labor, and I've done it for the residents, come back and help them out, you know, to help do a breech delivery they have in their house staff cases. But it depends how the resident gets confident and how they feel.
Are any of your colleagues that you practice with interested in?
No.
No. Nobody.
It's easier for them to do cesarean section, and they probably get paid more. And they sleep more than I do.
I bet that's true. How was your recovery from your vaginal breech after cesarean?
It was amazing. I was walking around, and I was completely fine after 36 hours. I think I asked them to discharge me after 36 hours.
You're ready to go.
I was ready to go.
You had some cleaning to do. You got to clean the house.
Yeah, I did. And I did. I was running errands.
I bet you were.
It was great.
So thank you very much for sharing these stories. I think I'm grateful to the doctors who still offer vaginal birth as an option.
Absolutely.
You know, and are able to tell the criteria, what's going to be a safe candidate versus not a less safe candidate. And feedback separately, there's large swaths of the country. Many of our listeners call in and write in and talk about the fact that they can't find a doctor even to do a vaginal birth after cesarean, just a plain old VBAC. And so the combination of both is unique, but I think it's really important that you pointed out they're just 2 separate sets of risks. If you're willing to take the risk of the uterine rupture, the 1 in 200 on average, and the risks of the breech birth, if you meet the safety criteria, they don't compound each other. And so if you can find a doctor who does breech and VBAC, maybe they'll also do vaginal breech after cesarean. I appreciate you both for being here and also Dr. Brock for sharing your expertise. Where can we find you guys online?
I'm at BeverlyGroveDentistry.com.
And if once you're getting your teeth looked at, you might as well come across the street and get an adjustment.
Right.
And you switched practices recently.
Yes, I'm on Rodeo Drive, 421 Rodeo Drive in the penthouse there. And, I'm still deliver at Cedars. And
so right after
the Rodeo Collection in Beverly Hills. And the good thing is it's cheaper than Cedars because there's 2 hours free parking around the corner.
No kidding, really? Yeah, but when you stop at, BCBG on the way.
Well, yeah, I don't stop at those things. I look at them. I can't afford a T-shirt there.
All right. At home, thanks for listening to the Informed Pregnancy Podcast. If you have a topic you'd like to discuss, send your suggestions to info@informedpregnancy.com.
I got a whole lot of questions for you. This kid's gonna test my will. I got a lot to learn and my baby's due.
This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike. Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby, not even diaper rash.